With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny.
This week, I'm getting drunk and chatting with food writer Rachel McCormack about her book Chasing the Dram, Finding the Spirit of Whiskey. Rachel McCormack is a regular panellist on BBC Radio 4's The Kitchen Cabinet and has also broadcast on the stations From Our Own Correspondent, The Food Programme, and appeared as an expert guest on BBC Radio 2 on both The Simon Mayo Show and The Chris Evans Show. Rachel is the author of Chasing the Dram, Finding the Spirit of Whiskey, which we're going to talk about today. Rachel, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thank you for having me.
And I should say before we start that I know absolutely nothing about whiskey and also think, and I say think, I don't like it. And Rachel's going to try and convince me that I'm wrong. She calls herself the whiskey whisperer in the book, and she's going to try and convince me. She's brought some samples in, so fingers crossed. But before we get to that, Rachel, tell us how you got into whiskey.
Well, the honest truth is what happened was I was trying to get a book doing Spanish food and no one wanted one because I used to live in Spain, and what I'm best known for on the radio is talking about Spanish food. And what I used to do when I lived in London was do various supper clubs and do various events to do with Spanish and particularly Catalan food, but nobody wanted one. And then I was thinking, we don't have a history in Scotland at all or any kind of tradition of cooking with whiskey. And I thought that's actually really quite interesting. If you look at recipes from the 19th century from Spain and from Italy, they very often sort of interchange without thinking about it, either wine or brandy, because they had quite small local domestic production of brandy that we didn't have. So we never really had a chance to develop that tradition. And I thought maybe we should. So rather than just saying, let's have a cookbook with some whisky recipes, I thought, well, what if I go around Scotland and have a look at what whisky is like in Scotland and also what whisky means to Scotland, because it's so much more than a drink. So I thought, what if I do a road trip with recipes? And then I thought, there is not one publisher in the entire world that is going to let me do a road trip with recipes. And then one did. So then I thought, well, and I have to write this book and I have to go around Scotland. And I learned an awful lot more than I expected about what whisky means to Scotland and how much it's more to, it's almost like the way the Mediterraneans treat food. If you really want to get to know Spanish culture, or you want to get to know any Mediterranean culture, like Egyptian culture or Lebanese culture, if you start with their food, people will tell you things about themselves that you don't realise. They will tell you who they are, where they're from. If you know a bit about any kind of history of movement of food and people, you know who's invaded them, who they've invaded, what's happened. And also for them, that's the idea of hospitality and conviviality. Round a table eating is what you do to say that you belong, to show hospitality to other people, to say that you belong somewhere, to be convivial. And I realised that actually all of that stuff in Scotland is whisky. It's not food at all. So whisky is so much more than just a drink. And the best person really to show me that is, bizarrely, Compton Mackenzie in his book Whiskey Galore. Now, everybody will probably remember the film The Ealing Comedy, and it is really, really funny. And the book is really funny, but what the book does really well is it shows you how much whisky means to these islanders, and there being no whisky means they cannot be hospitable. You walk into their house and they can offer you tea, they can offer you ale, or they can offer you ginger beer. It's not whisky. It's not hospitality. And although the point is you might not want a whiskey, so you're totally free to refuse it, but the point is they need to have it to offer it to you, which struck me as really interesting that we would have a drink that meant everything that food means to the Mediterranean.
Going back to something you've just said, like going into this book, I would have thought, not knowing that much about whiskey, but I know that, you know, there are single malts and things, and we'll get onto what they are in a bit, but I understood that those are the things that people thought were, like, you know, the good stuff. And so I would have presumed that there was lots of small producers in the way that you've just described what happens in, like, you know, France and Spain. So what is the whisky industry in Scotland like?
So varied, it's unbelievable. I mean, you have things like the big blended, the big grain distilleries. To make blended whisky, which is actually 90% of Scotch whisky sales around the world, you need grain whisky, which is done in a continuous still. So there's only about seven of them in Scotland, and they produce, the one in Glasgow, the Strathclyde distillery, probably produces about 10 times the amount of the biggest malt distillery in Scotland, which is Glenfiddich. And there's things like Glenfiddich are maybe producing 6 million litres of whisky a year, and they're owned by a big company called Grants. It's still a family company. It's been going for over 100 years. Then you have a company like Diageo, which owns about a third of the industry, and they own, I think, maybe 1.5 grain distilleries and about 30 or 40 malt distilleries. And although they're very much owned and organised on a very big scale, if you go to the distillery, if you go to a Diageo-owned distillery like Talisker or Lagavulin, it's actually exactly the same process as going to a tiny artisanal distillery like the Glasgow distillery. And the Glasgow distillery's only been open a year, and it's owned by about three guys. They've had investment from the Middle East, and it's in a lockup on the south side of Glasgow in an industrial estate, and all of the mash tuns and the stills are kind of freestanding. And it looks like a real kind of tiny outfit. And so I think in the whisky industry, there's everything from these really big industrial grain distilleries to these tiny ones owned by a few people. But the difference with a malt distillery is you go in and you realise that the process in every single malt distillery is essentially the same. And you would know it was owned by a bigger company just because maybe they'd have, say, seven stills, or they'd have like seven washed stills and seven spirit stills, whereas the Glasgow distillery's only got two. But then I think Talisker's only got two stills, two low wine stills and two spirit stills. And they're now producing double of what they used to because they're now going 24/7. But then the Glasgow distillery is about to double its production because they're about to go 24/7. So actually, from a big owner to a small owner, there's not really that much difference in the actual process.
You hinted at what whisky means culturally to Scottish people. But what does the industry mean to Scotland?
Well, it's the third biggest industry. Our biggest industry is oil, our second industry is technology, and the third biggest industry is whisky. I think if you live in London, I think you think there's some kind of parity between Irish and Scottish whisky because you can very often get, because of the amount of Irish that lived in London, there's still a very strong tradition of drinking Jameson's. So people in London always say, oh, you know, but how much is Irish whisky worth in terms of the industry? The Scotch whisky industry produces, there's a very specific alcohol spirit measurement, which is a case, and I think it might be like 13 bottles or something, that isn't a proper actual case that you can buy. And the Irish whisky industry produces 6 million a year, and the Japanese whisky industry produces 6 million a year, and the Scotch whisky industry produces 100 million a year. So it's just, it's a completely different level of money and size of industry.
Beyond that, what's the difference between, apart from the spelling, what's the difference between Irish and Scots whisky? And I want to broaden that out as well. If we bring into it, you know, something like bourbon or whatever, a bottle of Maker's Mark or something, what's the difference?
Well, the difference is what they often use to make the whisky. I mean, a malt whisky, you can only use malted barley and nothing else. And I think with bourbon, they use a lot of corn in their mash. And the other thing with bourbon is they can only use their barrels once, so their barrels are all new. There was an agreement between the Union of Coopers, I think, in the early 20s. I can't remember the exact date. It was in sort of early 20th century. And their agreement was that they would only use new barrels so that the coopers still had work. So that means that all the barrels would end up getting exported to Scotland, and we use them because we always use casks that have already been used. We don't use new casks. So that's one of the differences. The differences with the Irish whiskey, the thing that Irish whiskey has is it's always triple distilled. If it's not always malt whiskey, but it's normally pot stilled. They don't use a continuous still. Even if they make a malt whiskey, they distill it three times. And the only Scotch whiskey that's distilled three times continuously all the time is Auchentoshan. And there's one of the Campbelltown whiskies, Hazelburn, is distilled three times. but that's not very normal in Scottish whisky. It's only in Irish whisky that's distilled three times, which makes it sweeter. Also, I would say the difference between, say, bourbon and Irish whiskey and Scotch is because they just don't have the variety of tastes. I mean, we have everything that from, say, a Balvenie that's really sweet and kind of cinnamony and peppery to something like a really, really heavy Lagavulin, which is just tastes of kind of peat bogs and perfume. And no one has that range. And also, I think our range of prices. I mean, you can buy blended whiskey in a supermarket for, say, £10 for a 75 centilitre bottle, and you can buy like a really, really old Black Bowmore. I think the last one sold for like £100,000. So there's like a massive range of prices with Scotch whisky that bourbon and Irish whisky doesn't have.
Blended whisky, again, in my ignorance, I would always presume, you know, because blended whisky is a thing you see in the supermarket most of all, and probably some of the more famous names if you're not that involved in knowing about whisky. And so I've always presumed that it was, you know, it was a bit rubbish. But I was amazed at what goes into it, really. So a bottle of Johnny Walker has like 32 different blends in it. How does that work?
So there's 32 different malt whiskies in Johnny Walker. And I'd say about, the thing is, being a blend, see Johnny Walker, Ballantine's, Famous Grouse, they're 85% grain whiskey. So 85% of the whiskey has been made in one of these big continuous distills. And then the 15%... added, more or less, it's not that exact number, and you'll not find out exactly what the percentages are, is then a different malt whiskies. But most of these malt whisky distilleries, especially ones on Speyside, were set up for the blending industry. And what happened, I think, with blends was they were softer, because you think a lot of the time in the 19th century when the whisky industry really took off, a lot of these, the barley was being malted using peat, and then the pot stills were being heated by gas or by oil, so they were really heavy. So what you'd then have with these grain, because these grain whiskies were much lighter, they would blend them together to make a blend that suited southern Scottish and English palates, and then that suited the palates of people abroad because they weren't so heavy. I mean, the malt whisky industry's really changed over the past 100 years, but even now you'll still find malt whiskies that you can't get on the market, because every single bit of this malt whisky goes into the production of Chivas or the production of Ballantine's or the production of Johnny Walker, so they don't sell them on the market. I mean, malt whisky's been sold on the open market really only started in the 60s. Glenfiddich started it because the Grants didn't have grain distillery, and so they were having problems getting grain whisky, so they just got really fed up and decided to start selling malt whisky at the same time the airport duty-free started, because that was, you know, when people going into airports and flying started to become a much more normal thing, so they needed something to buy at the duty-free. So that Glenfiddich started selling malt whisky, and they were the first malt whisky to really start mass marketing. So then after that, other people then started labelling their malt whiskies. I mean, something like Kalila has only been available as a malt, I think maybe since about the early 2002 maybe. You know, it's not been on the market long, and they've been making Kalila for over 100 years. It's just that it's all gone into the production of blended whisky.
And there's also brands that are made in Scotland and sold abroad that we'd never get here, isn't there?
It really depended on what took off in the 19th century. I mean, so there's a brand in Colombia called Old Parr, and it's called Grand Old Parr, and it was originally made by a greengrocer and wine merchant in London. And Grand Old Parr was supposed to be something to do with, named after Tom Parr, who was supposed to be the oldest man in England. So again, they were very much playing on that idea of things being old and older whiskey being better and things being mature. And they think that something must have happened in that Old Parr must have been smuggled across from Panama to Colombia at some point, and it really just caught people's imaginations. And Old Parr in Colombia, something like 50% of the Scotch whisky sales in Colombia are Grand Old Parr, and it's not been sold in the UK since like the early 80s. No, you just can't get it here. And they have carnivals. There's a town in the Caribbean coast of Colombia called Barranquilla, and they have a carnival, and a section of their carnival is the Old Parr Carnival. And they sell Old Parr as the foreign drink with the Colombian heart, just because it's theirs. It's almost like it's not nothing to do with us anymore. And when you do that, you notice if you go around different countries in the world, you're really surprised at the malt whisky that they, or the blended whisky that they drink. It can be stuff that, you know, British people have never heard of because they've just never seen it. In Scotland, the biggest selling blended whisky is Famous Grouse. So people always assume that Famous Grouse will be everywhere, but you go to Spain and, I mean, Famous Grouse, you can get it, but it's not a really popular blend. The popular blend is J&B or Glencampbell, and Glencampbell you can hardly get in Scotland.
Anyone familiar with French wines in particular, uh-huh, will know that the wines are, they're named after, you buy the wines depending on what region that wine comes from. And the point of that is the terroir, the land that the wine is, that the grapes are grown on, is important to the end product. And whiskies have regions, don't they? There are regions, but you talk in the book about how actually the place itself is not necessarily that important.
Not anymore. I think the thing is with modern methods of distilling, it's really not important anymore. It was supposed to be. I mean, Islay whiskey is the famously heavy peated whiskey. Speyside whiskey is lighter. I mean, I always say if you want to start from like lighter to heavier whiskey, you start off in the lowlands, you kind of go around Scotland anti-clockwise and you go up to Speyside, and then the further west you go in the Highlands, the heavier the whiskey is. And so, for example, if there are people I know that don't like peated whiskey at all, and I will say to them, well, don't drink anything west of Glenmorangie because you won't like it. But at the same time, then there's some Speyside distilleries that are making peated whiskey. Islay, then Brewladdy is now making, Brewladdy distilleries on Islay, and they're now making an unpeated whiskey. But I'd say as a general rule, you can kind of say that the further west that you go, the kind of heavier and peatier it is. But then there's this two new distilleries on the Western Isles, one in Lewis and one in Harris, and I have no idea what kind of whiskey they're making. I very much doubt it's light and Speyside-ish, but you just never know.
And as I said, we're going to try some in a bit, but if I do develop a liking for whiskey...
Uh-huh.
Can I make my own?
Not advisable. It's illegal. For a start, it's illegal. And for a second, it's really, really dodgy. You probably would poison yourself. You have to be really, really careful. When you're distilling whiskey, the first thing that you have to do is you have to take off the foreshots and the faints. So the foreshots have too many kind of heavy alcohol esters in them, and they're the ones that can make you go blind. And then the faints at the end have, they don't, it doesn't have enough alcohol in it, so it doesn't have enough taste. And both of them go back to get redistilled. People do have illegal stills somewhere. Apparently there might still be one in Scotland. But there was a rumour that in the 1980s, the karate club in Stornoway were making their own. And sometimes you might find someone in a weird, out-of-the-way place will have a tiny wee still and be making stuff more as a hobby. But someone said to me, nowadays all the people who used to be maybe making illegal whiskey are all now making legal gin, because you can make legal gin relatively cheaply and make some actual money as opposed to having to hide from the HMRC, because they will come and get you. They will tear your house apart to see if you've got an illegal still.
I'm Andrew Muller. Go and read some great new journalism and explore the interview archive at littleatoms.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Rachel McCormack. We're talking about her book, Chasing the Dram, Finding the Spirit of Whiskey. And
Rachel, throughout this book, you travel around Scotland, meeting people, experiencing things and trying whiskies, obviously. And I wanted to talk about some of those travels in the second part of the show. Tell me about this thing called the Dramboree.
There's a thing that whiskey people are really quite different, say, from gin people, because gin people can talk about botanicals and then they finish the conversation. Whiskey people start talking about barley and then they'll start talking about length of time of fermentation in a fermentation tank, and 4 days later they're still not even got to distilling. And they're really convivial, and there's various different festivals that you can go to. So one of them, you can go to Isle, and they have like a 4 day festival where it's a lot of, because Isle is very, most Isle whiskey is very peated. It's a very much a Scandinavian thing. Scandinavian market really like their peated whiskey, so it's kind of full of Scandinavians in camper vans for 4 days. And there's another one, there's a one you can go to in the Netherlands called Maltstock, which is essentially camping and talking about whiskey with 350 tall Dutch people. And there was no way I was going to do that. And I knew that for this book I had to do, I mean, it sounds just a laugh, but it was actual research. And I met somebody who'd set up this thing called Dramboree. And what he did was he started off with some friends saying, let's get together in a hostel, stay over a weekend, we'll bring a bottle of whiskey that we like to share, and you can tell me why you've brought this. It can be any kind of whiskey, but if you don't have anybody else that likes whiskey at home and you've got this bottle, you want other people to try, come along and have some whiskey. And it's now expanded until it's got about 70 people. So basically, you go to a youth hostel and you spend a weekend drinking whiskey and talking about whiskey. So it's kind of like Bible camp, but about whiskey. I mean, I don't know if you did, if like anybody listening was like in the Scripture Union or like Bible school or something.
Probably not listeners to this show.
As a teenager, well, you never know. People do weird things as teenagers. And so you ended up having to go camping and like singing Bible songs for a weekend. Well, this was the same thing, but for adults and about whiskey. And it was really funny because they are really, I'd never seen so many people who were utterly obsessed with the same thing. And if you ever go around a whiskey distillery, there's always these branded jackets and t-shirts and caps with like the name of the distillery and the name of the whiskey on them. Every single person apart from me was wearing something that weekend that they had bought at distilleries. They'd all been to loads of distilleries. They just talked about different types of whiskey and casks and had big discussions about who was doing what, where, and who had been to this distillery. And you can see it's their entire life. It's that, you know, they have a job, and apart from the job, their entire life is whiskey. And quite a lot of them even had given up their jobs to work in whiskey to become private bottlers or brand ambassadors and things like that. And they all kind of knew each other, and they would all see each other from different festivals. Because the Dramboree this year is this coming weekend, and half of them are all on Facebook going, who's coming and who's not coming and why am I not seeing you this year? Because it's like their annual meeting now.
There's another point in the book where you take a excursion with your father to visit a foundry where they build and repair the stills that are used for distilling whiskey. And one of the fascinating facts in the book, again, that I didn't know, was that the shape of the still has an impact on the taste of the whiskey. And to the extent that if an old still has got a dent in it or something, then when they order a new one, they'll want a similar dent in the new one. So there's a match to the taste. How important is it?
I am not sure. If you read things like scotchwhiskey.com, and they have an incredibly extensive kind of encyclopedia of whiskey, and you can look up the shape of every single distill and every single distillery, and it will tell you why this still is the shape that it is. I'm not entirely sure that everybody knows, but no one is taking any chances. I mean, there is definitely a difference in taste. If you think the heaviest whiskey is Laphroaig, and well, one of the heaviest whiskies is the malt whiskey Laphroaig, and their stills are really, really small, so they catch all these kind of heavy molecules that would not travel as far up a really tall still. And then a very light whiskey, kind of famous for being really light and fresh, is Glenmorangie, and their stills are sort of as tall as giraffes. It's one of their selling points. I was in Colombo Airport in Sri Lanka, but in sort of in between researching the book, I was there for something else to do with work. And they had like their entire selling shtick was like Glenmorangie with a toy giraffe beside them. And you're kind of going, what is this? Like, buy a bottle of Glenmorangie and get a free giraffe, or what's going on here? And it turned out their selling point is, you know, our stills are as tall as giraffes, and this is what gives us our unique taste. And there is a thing where people, they do have this very idea that a certain shape of still will give a certain type of character, and they want to keep that character. So there's a really old malt distillery in the Highlands called Mortlach. Now, Mortlach is now available as a malt, but it's only really recently been on the market as a malt. And its stills are completely different shapes from each other because the farmer that started off Mortlach had money to buy, put in a different still at a different time, and so just built them up. But they have to keep those shapes because that's those shapes and the combination of those different stills give Mortlach the taste that it's got. And it's a taste that everybody understands. Because the problem, if you're making whiskey, even for blends and even just for straight bottling, is that people expect a certain character from your whiskey. So if you don't have that character, then you're not your whiskey anymore. So, you know, the thing is, because most malt whiskey was going into blends, the blends need to be reliable. The thing with a blended whiskey, say Johnnie Walker Black or Ballantine's, is that you buy it in January in London and you buy it in June in Singapore. It really should have the same taste. So for that, you need really reliable malt whiskies that will taste exactly the same. So this is why one of the things is the shape still has to be exactly the same as it was before.
And also the blenders. I mean, the people that do that actual blending, these are, you know, incredibly skilled people.
And the thing about their skill is it's just to do with smelling and sometimes even looking. I mean, they're very modest, but you look at them and you see what they do and how they, when blenders taste, they put in a lot more water than the normal people would drinking whiskey. They put in, I think they dilute it to about 30%. And most of what they do is smelling. And they'll say, well, you know, that cask isn't going to work for this whiskey, so it has to go into something else. Or if we can combine these things, this will keep giving us the same taste that Johnnie Walker or Ballantine's always has.
I think we should try one.
Right,
before
what
we
would
carry
you
on.
Like to try? Why don't you start with, if you don't like whiskey, I want you to start off with Black Label.
Yeah, so we've got some Johnnie Walker, which we found in the studio. This is not even one that Rachel brought in. There was a bottle in the studio already. I haven't tried any Johnnie Walker since years ago when we interviewed Christopher Hitchens for this show because it was his tipple of choice. It smells like Christmas pudding.
Now, Johnnie Walker has, I think, is 40% normally? Let's have a look. Yep, it's 40%. Normally, normally whiskies are diluted down to 40%. So they come off the cask a certain strength and then they dilute them down to 40%. So that you can have with water, you can have it with soda. Johnnie Walker Black Label is the best-selling. Well, the Johnnie Walker brand is the best-selling whiskey in the world. Like, if Johnnie Walker sales stopped, the Scottish whiskey industry would collapse. It would lose about half of its income. Because one of the things about Johnnie Walker whiskey is it's become such a prestigious thing throughout the world that if you're looking at a developing country and you're looking at projected whiskey sales, before you even look at a marketing campaign, what you need to look at is their GDP. And if the GDP is increasing, you know that Johnnie Walker Red Label sales will increase, because if you can't afford a Rolex, you can't afford a Mercedes, you can afford a bottle of Johnnie Walker Red Label, it does say that you've arrived. The prestige that Scotch whiskey has in Latin America and in Africa and in Asia is really, really quite impressive to look at. I mean, it is partly to do with colonialism, and it is partly to do with these 19th century whiskey barons who just said, this is a luxurious drink that you need to have. And they went everywhere selling Scotch whiskey as this luxurious brand that was what you could buy if you couldn't afford a new car or a new house.
Now, this isn't horrible.
Okay. Well, it's a blend. So what is it that you don't particularly like about it?
Well, it burns. It's okay. Very fiery.
Well, in which case you want to put some water in, that's one of your problems. Put in some water and then see what you think.
I'm putting in some water. Probably put a bit too much water there. But yeah, that clearly tempers
that's
it
one
down
of things,
a bit.
If it burns, I mean, one of the things you have to be very careful as well is if you get a cask strength whiskey, which is sometimes as much as 59% alcohol, it's coming, it's the strength, it does what it says in the tin, it's the strength of alcohol that's come off the cask, it's not been watered down at all. And a lot of the times when you put in water, it does actually bring out a lot of the flavours because you don't get that pure alcohol burn. Also, what you're getting with Johnnie Walker is it is quite smoky. And what I've generally found, and it's not always true with everybody, if you think you don't like whiskey, the problem is that you don't like peated whiskey. You like Speyside whiskies, you'll maybe like East Highland whiskies, and you'll like Lowland whiskies, you'll like Auchintosh, and you'll like Balvenie, you'll maybe like Arran whisky or Macallan. You're not going to really like Lagavulin or Laphroaig. So, I mean, there are people that I know that if they just smell a Laphroaig and it makes them heave, but they actually do really like, say, an Arran whisky or Auchintosh.
Well, we've tried the Training Wheels whisky there, and I've passed that.
So the second one I'm going to want you to try is, so what you do is rinse your glass out with a bit of water, and then I want you to try a Glendronach, which is a Highland whisky, which is quite well known for being kept in sherry casks. So the two types of casks that whisky is generally matured in is our bourbon, ex-bourbon cask or ex-sherry casks. An ex-sherry cask gives you a very specific flavour. It's much softer. So I want you to try this. First of all, I want you to try it without water, and then I want you to add a wee bit of water, and I want you to see what you think about this one.
It definitely smells different as well. Oh, that's much nicer.
Mm-hmm. I thought you'd like that.
Yeah, I mean, that definitely has more of a
sherry taste.
A sherry feel to it. Yeah, absolutely. No, I like that. And in fact, I don't want to add any water to it. That's pretty good.
And see, that's the thing. I am convinced there is a whiskey for everybody. Actually, I was with somebody recently and we were in a pub in Belfast and I bought them a Glenkinchie, which is a lowland whiskey, and because they kept saying, I don't like whiskey, but they like rum, and I think they just all think that all whiskey is really smoky and fiery the way that Johnny Walker Black Label is. And they tried this Glenkinchie and their actual quote was, I really like that, but I'm not going to give you the satisfaction of finding a whiskey that I like because I don't like whiskey. So I think the thing is it's actually really fun. That's the thing I've realised in the past couple of years. Like when I'm talking about these people who go to Drambury and are absolutely obsessed with whiskey, one of the reasons that they're obsessed with whiskey is because they have so much fun. You know, they meet people, they meet a load of new people and they have these brilliant conversations. And again, it's that conviviality. I could see when you go to Drambury, it's a load of people all meeting and talking about whiskey and they're all sharing it in the way that Spanish people would be talking about food and sharing food. They're talking about whiskey, they're bonding, they're having a fantastic time, they're having a great weekend, they're showing people new things they've discovered, they've got other people telling them things. I mean, I've now joined, since I finished the book, and I don't have to do this anymore. I have joined Glasgow's Whisky Club, and it's great fun. I mean, you go every month, you try six whiskies, some you like, some you don't, and you see that, and they all go on day trips to distilleries like every couple of months, or they have an annual day trip to Campbelltown where they all get on the bus and go to Campbelltown for 5 hours. You know, they all go and spend far too much money in the shop, and then they all go back home on the bus, and you can see that they've kind of got a totally new world for them that's just great fun.
While I finish the last mouthful of this off, tell us about, there's a ceremony you go to in the book, I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce it,
The Keepers of the Quaigh. Well, the thing is, if you know anything about wine, you'd know that things like in Burgundy, if you've done an awful lot for the Burgundy industry, they'll make you like a Chevalier de Burgundy or something, where you kind of go to some kind of ceremony and you have to get dressed up and you maybe get crossed by a sword and all of a sudden you are like a gentleman of Burgundy. And it's a way that various wine regions or wine industries will thank you for work that you've done. And about 30 years ago, it was a South African Scot who worked in the whisky industry and must have worked for a company that also owned some Burgundy wine, and he saw the ceremony. I think he was being made a Chevalier in Burgundy, and he thought the Scotch industry has to do this. They have to say thank you to people who've done an awful lot for the Scotch industry, and if we're going to do it, we have to do it with every single company, not just one or two. And it has to be bigger than anybody else does, and it has to be better than anybody else does. So it is essentially an entire evening of just a complete orgy of tartan and bagpipes for an entire evening. You go to Blair Castle, it's a kind of faux medieval banqueting hall that's obviously Victorian, and the whole thing is just one big bagpipe, haggis swashing, harp playing, banqueting meal, where everybody's in tartan, all the men are in kilts, and it was hilarious. I mean, I'm not a big formal occasion person, but I just thought it was just amazing. If anybody listening ever gets invited to the Keeper's Banquet, and if you're living in Australia, just go for one night of your life. It is incredible. I mean, the funny thing is also watching, and you forget when you're Scottish, how much foreign men absolutely love wearing kilts. They think it's the best thing ever. They put a kilt on and they strut and they smile and they swish, and they're absolutely thrilled to the core to be in a kilt. And the French all seem to wear them on their hips. And then the Mexicans who were there, they had no idea how to walk in them, so they kept looking at all the old Scottish men that were there to try and copy how they were walking, because they'd never worn anything like this in their lives. And what they do, they take people to this Victorian banqueting hall, they give them an entire sort of formal ceremony, and they give them, and they induct them in the secret ceremony into being a keeper of the quaigh, and they give them a small quaigh. And a quaigh is like a really small drinking vessel, or it can be various sizes, but it's two-handled. And there is, as there is with everything in Scotland, an absolute load of nonsense stories about how it's actually a loving cup, and it was when you got married, you both drank from the same cup, and then that cup was used for a christening for a baby. And that's one of those stories that's completely made up, and bits of it may be even made up by me, because everybody makes up all these stories, like the way they make up tartan. But it was just hilarious. I mean, it was just brilliant to watch, and it was just such fun. And what I could see, again, it was the way that the Scotch industry is still really good at looking after its people. Because I think whatever industry you're in, one of the problems you have in every single department, every single kind of workforce, is keeping people's morale up. And if you have come, if you've done something for the Scotch whisky industry in Peru, and you've come from Peru and they're making you a keeper, you're going to go home, and whatever you're doing for the Scottish industry, you're going to do it twice as hard for years, because you will never forget that that's what they gave you in your entire life. And it just was great fun. And you could see, it, again, it was that whole idea of hospitality. You were there. It was a really formal event, but you were there to really enjoy yourself and have a really good time while dressed up in tartan.
What's the next whiskey we're going to try?
The next one is a Glenfarclas. And Glenfarclas are quite unusual in that their stills are still heated by gas. So they can end up having quite a strong taste that's different from the way other stills are heated now. And also Glenfarclas is still a family-owned company. They're stuffier. They always seem to be called Grants in Speyside. There's like the Grants that aren't the Grants from Glen Grant, and the Grants that aren't the Glenfarclas Grants. There's another set of Grants who's another founder of another distillery in the 19th century who's also a Grant. So I want you to try the Glenfarclas. This will be a bit stronger than the Glendronach, but have a try and see what you think. Also, Glen whiskies are almost always Bayside and Highland.
Well, it smells really good. It smells almost honey. Like, again, completely different from the last one that definitely smelled like it was sherry. Oh, wow. Yeah, that's a... Ooh.
Well, that's probably because, I forgot to tell you, that's cask strength. So that's probably 59% as opposed to 40%. So you'll want to put some water in that.
Yeah, I think I'm going to put a bit of water in this one. But the taste is... pretty good. You'll notice I'm saying all of these things are like a Scottish man. I'm basically saying this is it's all right. It's kind of good.
That's, I suppose, one of the things, you know, we're not a people given to kind of exaggerating California levels of enthusiasm. And, you know, everybody says something's no bad. It's like the best thing that you can say to anybody. And it is one of those quite strange things. If you're with, say, Americans tasting whiskey, and your Americans are really enthusiastic and they're saying, this is fantastic, this is great. Now the Scottish people are going, it's not bad. It's like, I mean, which for them is, this is absolutely amazingly wonderful, but we're all quite quiet about it.
So while I'm enjoying this one,
mm-hmm.
as you mentioned earlier, one of the ideas behind this book is that, you know, you want to encourage people to use whiskey in cooking more. So tell us something about that. The book has recipes in it, but what sort of things can we use whiskey in?
Well, I think if you look at any old French recipes that have brandy in them, you put whiskey in them instead, and you'll see the difference in... Whiskey has more interesting residuals than brandy, to be honest. Even any kind of blended whiskey, because it's got a blend of so many different things, the residuals will be more interesting. So you'll get a depth of flavour if you add whiskey instead of brandy. You can also do things like, different whiskies give you quite different tastes. And even if you just use blended whiskey, a Black Label's very different to a Ballantine's, and it's very different to Famous Grouse. So you find that if you use those three whiskies and you only use those three in different dishes, you would notice a slightly different taste. I really like making Gravidlax with whiskey. And I really like making it with like Highland Park or Springbank. But again, that isn't a cheap thing to do. You might rather use Black Label or Vat 69, which is quite a peated blend. And it's just easy. I mean, it's just things like, you know, I've done whiskey where I've just cooked mushrooms and butter and whiskey and a bay leaf and nothing else. And someone has stood and watched me do it and said, no, you've put pepper in that and you've put chilli in that and you've got other stuff that I don't know. And I'm like, no, I've not. You stood and watched me. I've just put whiskey in it, nothing else.
But then if you used a different whiskey in that one, it would taste different.
Oh, really different. I mean, if you do, I've got a recipe for something with Talisker whiskey, which is quite a peated whiskey. And it's chicken with a kind of like cream sauce. And if you put in Talisker in that, or you put in the Glendronach, you'd get a really, really different tasting dish. And was one of the things I did at Dranbury. We did some experiments of like putting salmon in with different types of whiskey so that you could taste the difference and see what worked better. And again, it gives you that variety, because, I mean, you know, the problem about cooking, if you're cooking at home, is that you don't really want to be constantly doing something new, because the powers of concentration that it takes. I mean, if you just come home from work, you just want something quick. And the fact that if you've got whiskey, you can use it and have quite a different taste in different times, and that's the only ingredient you've changed, is a different type of whiskey.
So the last one.
Now, the last one is, we will see whether you like this or not. This is the peated whiskey from Islay. It's now, a lot of Islay's distilleries are owned by big companies, and the only thing that happens on the island in these distilleries is the whiskey is made. The new mix is distilled, and then it's taken in a tankard off the island, and they put it in barrels in mainland Scotland. Kilcoman is a farm distillery where they keep their whiskey on site, and I think they bottle it on site as well. I could be wrong about the bottling, but I know they definitely keep the barrels on site. So it's peated whiskey, but it's not a very strongly peated whiskey, and it's quite a young whiskey. And they are one of those small independent companies that are just kind of going back to being farm distillers, which is what originally all whiskey was before blended whiskey started. So before grain distilling started, all there was malt distilling, and it was always done by farmers. So they're kind of going back to being a farm distillery.
Well, you've mentioned this all the way through the interview, and people would already know this, that malt whiskies are of the, you know, of the West Coast of Islay particularly, are famous for being peated. But what does that actually mean? Why does it smell
what
or
it
taste
means
peat?
What it means is that when you malt your barley,
yeah, it really does.
When you malt your barley, what you do is, when you're drying your barley off, once it's gone green and you're trying to dry it off in a kiln, you put in peat to dry it off, so you get the specific smell. The grains really, really take on. It's called, I think they put it in peat. It's called PPM, which is parts per million. And whiskey obsessives who are really geeky get really obsessed about what whiskey has parts per million of these phenols, because phenols are the thing that may give you that peaty taste. And there's a whiskey called Octomore, which is done by Brewladdy, which is supposed to be the peatiest whiskey in the world, but it just tastes of peat. It doesn't really taste of anything else. And there's a the guy who runs a private bottler called Cadenheads, who's based in Campbelltown, and he's in the book Mark Watt. His explanation for it is, these people get obsessed, and it's kind of like the curry on a Friday night. And who can have the strongest curry on a Friday night? Who can have the peatiest whiskey? And peat's a really, I mean, peated whiskey is something you either like or you don't. If you do like it, you really like it. And if you don't like it, it's just not for you at all. It doesn't mean that you don't like whiskey, it's just you don't like peated whiskey. And you have to see. Also, you can train yourself. I mean, I had my friend Sherry came over, and we went up to Oban, and she tried a Laphroaig, and she hated it. And she said she didn't like whiskey. And after 3 days, she actually really liked peated whiskey. It just took 3 days of tasting different things.
I think this is, I mean, it clearly is a acquired taste, but the taste is great. I mean, it is, the smell is really great. And no, I really like this one. I mean, of all of them, I think the sherry one was my favourite.
The first one.
Of all of them. But my issue with the drink is the heat of it, not the taste. So while I was reading the book, you were talking to people who were saying, like, the issue they have with the peat is they don't like the taste of the peat. But I think the taste of the peat is great. I mean, this is really a good drink.
I mean, I love peated whiskey, but it's just some people don't. And it just was a thing that I noticed, that if people didn't like whiskey, it was because it was too fiery or it was too peaty. That was the two things I noticed that they really didn't like. And fiery whiskey isn't as common as peated whiskey when you start getting into malts. I mean, if you're finding, I just think you have to find the one that you like, and it's quite fun. You know, you can go out with, say, a different people and stand in a whiskey bar and go, can we even just smell these bottles? And see what kind of one you think, oh, I fancy trying that one. I mean, for me, whiskey, the thing about whiskey, I think it's like middle-aged clubbing. I think if you're too old to be going out clubbing on a Saturday night, and if you remember what a Saturday night meant to you when you're kind of in your heyday in your early 20s, and it was the thing you looked forward to and how fun it was, and then at one point you kind of find yourself standing in the club going, everybody here's almost young enough to be my child, and I need to go home, and I can't be bothered with this. Whiskey is kind of that middle-aged club, and you get that thrill and that enjoyment from trying a new whiskey and enjoying sharing a whiskey with somebody and giving somebody else a whiskey that they like and finding one that's new that you like. I mean, I have seen, like, people's faces who've, like, been willing to come out with me to... There's a pub in Glasgow called The Pot Still, and it's got about 700 whiskies.
700 whiskies?
Uh-huh. And they come, you know, they come with me, and after about three goes, I find a whiskey that they like, and their face just lights up because they're like, I thought I didn't like whiskey. And I'm going, well, you do. You just like that one.
I think going into this as someone who claimed not to like whiskey, this one, I've now decided, is my favourite of the four.
This happens a lot. This is what I find really funny, because the Kilcoman whiskey is a really, really nice whiskey. A really, really, really good whiskey. So what you should probably do then is start looking and exploring the Islay whiskies and see what you think of them. Again, it's something that you found that you like that you didn't know. And it's fun.
One more question then. Mm-hmm. So this book is subtitled Finding the Spirit of Whiskey. Mm-hmm. So what is the spirit of whiskey in Scotland and did you find it?
I think it's the idea of conviviality. It's the fact that people take things personally about whiskey and it's the conviviality of it. I was with a friend from whose father is from Islay and we were in the pot still one night and she wanted to buy me a drink and I said, why don't we get the Kilcoman? And she said, oh, that's the farm behind Dave's farm. Oh, I know the one you mean, and it's up that wee road round there. And I said, well, I'll get this one, and why don't you get another one, and then we can kind of swap around. And she kind of touched my arm and went, no, we'll get the same one, and then we can share, we can have the same one together. And I thought she'd never say that about food or wine or gin. For her, this idea was we were partaking of the same thing and sharing in that kind of spirit of conviviality together, having the same drink. And I realised that was almost hardwired into her DNA in a way that kind of sharing food is hardwired into somebody's DNA from if they're from the Mediterranean. It's completely normal for her to actually say, no, this is a special moment and we're going to share this moment together drinking the same whiskey in this pub. So that to me is kind of the spirit of whiskey. It's that idea of conviviality and hospitality and having fun and enjoying yourself.
So I've been talking to Rachel McCormack. We've been talking about her book Chasing the Dram, Finding the Spirit of Whiskey, which is out now from Simon & Schuster. Rachel, thanks for coming in and talking to Little Atoms today.
Thank you very much for having me.
I think your whiskey whispering skills might have worked again, or I might just be wasted, I'm not sure.
I'm sure they've worked.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
You can find the Little Atoms podcast on iTunes and you can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
If you'd like to donate a little money to support the show, you can do so at littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.